Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to a very special episode of the No Film School podcast. I am Jason Hellerman, and today I'm joined by guest Evan Littman. For those of you who don't know or don't read No Film School all the time, Evan's written a couple articles for us, but he is a consultant in the distribution market. He works with writers, directors, producers, and other companies analyzing scripts, deciding packages should make it. He works at all the major markets, AFM, Cannes, Berlin. Evan and I met a few years ago, and I'm really excited to have him on the podcast. Hello, Evan.
Hello. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. Now, the reason I wanted to have you, and you know, this is a conversation we had had outside No Film School, and I figured it would be beneficial for our listeners to bring you on and talk a little bit more, is, you know, if you're just joining us, the SAG strike has ended. Voting's still going to go on in the next couple of weeks, but the general assumption around Hollywood is that it'll be ratified, and actors as well as writers have gone back to work. Now, we get to ask No Film School questions every week. People have written in, and in the past couple of weeks, I've gotten the same question from, I think, six or seven people. Shout out to Peter in Virginia Beach, Grace in Florida, and also Stephen in London. Cheerio, London, Stephen. All three of you have written in with the same question, which is, now that the strikes are over, what does the Hollywood marketplace look like? So I figured I would bring someone in who is dealing with the marketplace every day, which is Evan. And we're going to kind of talk about, what does Hollywood look like moving forward as these strikes have ended, not only for the end of 2023, which we're in right now, but into 2024. So Evan, you know, I'm sure maybe you had a quiet summer. What was the summer like during the dual strike for you?
It was pretty nerve-wracking for myself and for a lot of people. It was kind of interesting because summer tends to be kind of long in the indie space. You have Cannes in May, usually like beginning, middle of May. And then there's AFM, which actually just wrapped up, and we can talk about that. And then there's Toronto in September, which is usually not as much of a market, but recently has been kind of like where people will sell projects that they weren't able to get together for Cannes, or they think maybe the AFM will be too crowded. So yeah, the summer was, it was definitely interesting. And there were a lot of projections and predictions from people, all of whom were in some way correct and also some in some way wrong, including myself. So I'm glad that everything is wrapped up. Fingers crossed that SAG will ratify and more projects can get off the ground.
Yeah. So let's pretend there wasn't a strike this summer. You're going to Cannes, you're going to Berlin, you're going to AFM. What, you know, give our listeners a rundown of what you would do, you know, when you arrive at one of these places, and then, you know, where scripts and storytelling fits into that.
Sure. So I'll talk a little bit about what I do more broadly and how the markets fit into it. I work in the independent pre-sales market, and that's not the same as what the studios do, because the studios are basically like giant revolving credit facilities that own intellectual property. The independent market is a little bit different. Independents are usually production companies, sales agencies, maybe some, you know, conglomeration of the two. And what they do is they get a package together. It's usually going to be a script and maybe a star, and they will go to one of these markets. And what they will do is they will talk to distributors in all the different territories, all the different countries. Usually they're targeting theatrical distribution. And so they will talk to each of them. So for example, they'll talk to a couple of distributors in Turkey, and they'll say, hey, we have this new project. It's going to be awesome. It's, you know, what's the No Film School giant action movie XYZ. It's going to be amazing. You know, we are happy to license you distribution rights for theatrical distribution for this, for, you know, I don't know, 40 grand. And they will make that deal in Turkey with the Turkish distributor. They'll do it in Portugal with the Portuguese distributor, in Germany with the German distributor, and so on and so on. And they'll get different amounts of money because Germany can pay like, you know, 1 million, 2 million. And it's a much bigger market, whereas Turkey may not. And then they'll have all those amounts of money promised to them. And they will take those promissory notes and basically borrow against it. And they will use that money that they borrow to make the movie. So that's how independent films a lot of times get made. There's a lot of companies in the market that do that. Fewer than there used to be, but there's still like quite a few to the extent that distributors get to choose which projects. And if they need help choosing which projects, they will call me. And so what happens is all of the companies that are trying to sell or license those movies, pre-selling, right? Because the movie isn't made yet. They'll send me the script, and the distributor that has hired me to look at the script, I will look at it. I'll write up like a report for them. I'll talk to them about like what I think, including, you know, some comps, like comparable movies. And then, you know, we will discuss and they will make their offer, at least their best offer, depending on how, you know, they feel about it. And maybe if there's some other projects that that same company is selling, they might say, hey, you know, we can only do this, but we'll take all of these movies for, you know, $100,000 or something like that. So that's kind of a really, really quick rundown of kind of what I do. And then the way markets fit into that is that's kind of like the big selling places and times, right? So Cannes is usually like, I don't know, somewhere between like May 5th and May 15th. AFM usually like from like Halloween through like first week of November. And Berlin is usually like, I don't know, second week of February. So like February 10th through 18th or something like that. Toronto is somewhere in September, something like that as well. So when you go to one of those markets, all of these companies have what they call booths, but really they're renting just like very, very nice hotel rooms. And they've got their posters and marketing materials, and they've got TVs with like screeners on them or promos or sizzle reels or, you know, digital lookbooks or whatever they call it. And the prospective buyers will go in, they'll talk to them, they'll talk to the salespeople whom they know very well because we see each other every market. And then they will try to close the deal for whatever project it is. So that's the overall rundown.
The grand rundown, yeah.
Yeah.
For listeners who maybe are like, this sounds familiar, but I can't quite place it. Evan has written a couple articles on No Film School, which we'll link in the podcast article on our site. One, if you remember, a pretty popular article for us was, I used Evan's script consulting service. I submitted a script to it, and then we went through the feedback, you know, so we'll make sure that's linked as well. And Evan also had a list of things script consultants look for when they're reading specs, which I think maybe is a great transition into the strikes are done. The markets are kind of back up and running. People are putting together packages. You know, we kind of understand a little bit what Hollywood looked like last year at this time, but what are the differences that you're seeing now as these markets emerge, you know, in a post-strike era?
Yeah. So the SAG strike had actually a bigger impact. I didn't think that it would, but this AFM was so light. And I think the reason, I mean, I've heard this from a couple places. I don't know how true it is, but it feels true for whatever that's worth, is that, you know, with the end of the strike in sight, you had actors holding off on signing up for indie movies because they wanted to keep their schedules clear for like actual, like real money. Right. I mean, like, let's just say, right, because indie isn't going to pay as much as like the next Marvel movie or whatever it is. So, you know, if you can't do that movie, well, you're not going to make the money. So this was pretty light. So as far as the projects that I was seeing, you know, A24 showed up with like a good slate of interesting projects as they always do. They're kind of the indie darling, but they bring interesting stuff. And they, frankly, A24 like has like the balls to bring interesting stuff. Not every indie company is trying to do what A24 is trying to do. Some are just trying to kind of like stick to their guns with these like mid-range action movies, which aren't quite what they used to be. So that can sometimes be tougher, but A24 believes in themselves, and they bring not just like what we would call elevated horror, but also, you know, other interesting dramas from really talented like directorial voices.
Yeah, absolutely. I think A24 winds up being an aspirational company for so many people to work with just because of the, you know, the star and the veneer that goes with it of just, you know, being somewhere. Let me interrupt you quickly. You touched a little bit on some of the genres that people are looking. Is there always a predominant genre that you feel like, you know, most of these companies are selling X, Y, or Z internationally? You know, is it always action heavy or horror heavy?
Yeah. So people, it's kind of funny. Horror is always in demand. It's more in demand now than it ever was. And the reason is pretty simple. Like horror is a great communal theatrical experience in a way that a lot of action movies are not necessarily. A lot of action movies, especially action movies with like people that you don't know, or a lot of like the straight to video, straight to streaming projects, I feel like a lot of viewers view them as a little bit more disposable. Whereas like horror movies, it's like, oh, we're going to go see that. It's the new Blumhouse, new A24. They want to go to theaters and it's going to be awesome. Right. Like and I'm pleasantly surprised by that, because horror a lot of times is home to new breakout original and really interesting voices. And so that's what people want. And they want it in the indie space too. It took them a while to come around to it, because it used to be kind of the opposite. Actually, it used to be like, well, action belongs on the big screen. That's what's going to get people in theaters, and horror, man, that could just go straight to DVD. But it's not quite like that anymore.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Yeah, it's funny. And sometime around the early 2000s, and, you know, there might be other examples, but Saw is the biggest one I can think of, where Saw was supposed to be made to be a straight to DVD thing. And then there wound up being, you know, a theatrical window open. They needed to plug something in. They plugged Saw in, and, you know, over $100 million later, you know, then with nine movies that probably get them close to $1 billion later, yeah, it became a turning point truly in Hollywood and whatever. The turning point we're at now, I think you kind of touched on a little bit, this post-strike world, people are playing it a little bit safer. That's the echo I've been hearing around, which is like, what do we have that will definitely make money? You know, whether it's actors who are signing on to big budget studio movies, or, you know, looking at smaller budget movies and saying like, what's the genre? Will this be popular? You know, the strike at times can feel like out of sight, out of mind. I know one of the biggest worries I had marching back and forth was like, is anybody going to be like, remember my name after this? You know, like, will I come back? And I'm sure, you know, in the acting profession, obviously, you know, there are men and women who are looking like, will I be on the cover of a movie? Will I be the thumbnail on Netflix after this and this sort of thing? So, you know, are you finding the things are being submitted? Like, are there bigger names in these, what would typically be smaller genre movies, or like, is most of it feel like, oh, these are like the people I'm used to seeing in the studio fare, and then also, you know, sort of other people in leftover titles?
Yeah, so it's the indie space has always been driven by names, and that part of that is just by virtue of how necessarily international it is, right? It's, you know, you can mistranslate a tagline, but you can't mistranslate DiCaprio's face, right? So like, everybody wants to know, or Nicolas Cage's face, as the case is more often, but everybody wants to know like who's going to be in it, right? And so, but the thing is, of course, that not only do indies not pay as much, but like they frequently take longer to get an indie project together because financing can sometimes be slapdash. You know, you're just like trying to cobble loans and equity and tax incentives together. And then, so what I see is companies trying to either feature or do something interesting with maybe like name actors that are not like, put my face on the poster, I'm leading this $300 million movie, right? So like character actors that kind of have like little renaissances, I feel like that's like an underutilized pocket. And I love to see that, right? I love, like, one of my favorite things is like comedy actors like playing against type, because that's where, you know, if somebody does that and they're in a movie, then you're like, dude, did you see that, you know, Jim Carrey doing something dark or whatever it is, and people be like, oh yeah, I heard about that. It's a real easy way to get people like refer to your movie shorthand and take up that mental real estate. Maybe they'll buy a ticket.
That's a great strategy. Do you see a lot of shorts being submitted, you know, like along with screenplays if they're adaptations, or is that not so much?
No. I hope I'm not crushing anyone's soul when I say that like nobody really cares about shorts. And I tell people this all the time, because sometimes people want me to like look at their shorts to be like, hey, what do you think about this? Is this good? Could I submit this anywhere? There was like a brief period of time, probably like, I don't know, 10 years ago, maybe, where there a bunch of shorts were getting like picked up for adaptation. But those, if you look at those closely, I think they were kind of being like godfathered in under like much bigger name directors like Peter Jackson or like Ridley Scott or something. Shorts, I don't think that they're really like a viable avenue to like submit with the screenplay. whether it's an actual short or just a short screenplay. The reason is pretty simple. The discipline required to make a short, like it's not even really the same medium, right? Like a short film is like a few scenes. You just don't have the real estate to like really tie threads and character arcs together in the way that a feature does. So it doesn't, a good short doesn't necessarily translate.
What are the packages they're bringing to you basically are just, you know, headshots of actors, this is who's in it, and then the screenplay, correct?
Yeah, and sometimes there's like, I mean, I'm gonna out myself here. Sometimes there's like lookbooks or whatever, and they're like, here, see, take a look at this link to director sizzle reel. This really shows like their absolutely stunning, never before seen visionary take on this. I'm like, yo, I'm not watching that. I'm reading the script because the script is the thing that's actually gonna be on screen. The sizzle reel, which is like basically just like a super cut trailer of like other movies that I hope this movie is as good as, that doesn't do anything for me. Yes, I wish this movie was as good as all those Oscar winning movies, but what is this movie? Well, that's in the script. That's not in the lookbook or the sizzle reel.
Yeah, I think, again, most of the people who are coming to know Film Score are looking for, how do I get to the step where someone's taking my project and bringing it to AFM or bringing it to Cannes, bringing it to Toronto and trying to sell it with these people? Obviously, with the strikes ending, Hollywood kind of feels like the Wild West again. It always feels like the Wild West. Maybe now it just feels like we're in Deadwood and you're trying to figure out, you know, like, what are the rules? You know, like, who's Al Swearengin? How do we get to the OK Corral? Whatever, you know, like, pull all the metaphors in and, you know, mix them up. But, you know, if you're giving advice to younger filmmakers now, it's like, what do you think the step is before they get to you? You know, like, how do they find these producers? What's the best way in? Or do you have a way that you think is, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, like when you say like, is there a way? Obviously, like every single way is like extremely low percentage chance, right? This industry is hard. The strikes are over, but that doesn't mean it got easier. It means it got harder, right? And so I actually think that the best way is to kind of do what you do, which is you have to write a lot, and it all has to be like of a consistent professional quality. Right. Because one thing that I tell people is, you know, if you're writing to like kind of like please the market, like, dude, I can't tell you how many scripts come across my desk that are, you know, hitman takes on one last job and somehow, rescues a hooker with a heart of gold. Yo, I wish I was the target for that hit and somebody was going to kill me instead of reading another one of those scripts. So like that, but that stuff is so generic that like it can't be someone's favorite script. It's definitely not mine. Right. And the thing is, the marketplace is so difficult that you kind of need a champion, especially if you're newer, and your champion needs your script to be their favorite script. Because a lot of times they can't go to their boss with two scripts and say, hey man, what do you think about both of these? They go to their boss with the script and they go, this script is awesome. And if they're not saying that about your script, and they're saying it about somebody else, and that means that your script is probably not going to get made. That's really hard. It has to be somebody's favorite. It doesn't have to be everybody's favorite, but it has to be somebody's favorite. And that,
it's the search for one, like, yes, voice. Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're digging around looking for that one person, the, you know, a singular champion, you know, preferably with links to money who can bring somebody else in. But I do think it's interesting. You know, as we see the business change, I mean, in real time, you know, while the dust settles, you know, it seems like the end of 2023 is a lot of people figuring out what are the projects we had pre-strike? Are they still viable? You know, do they still fit the mandates we had beforehand? And then looking towards the future, you know, what's crack into the new stuff in 2024? I guess that's my read on it. Do you have a feeling just given the conversations you've been having?
I think people are still kind of scrambling right now, partially due to the availability. But again, it kind of like I mentioned, like it's not about, it's not as much about the writers in the indie space. Because your script can be amazing, but if they can't attach a face to it that somebody recognizes, then they're not gonna make it. Part of that might have to do with castability, right? If you're not writing roles that like an actor can actually like take, an actor that people care about can actually take, then it's like your script can be amazing, but it's gonna be super hard to cast. Let me rewind real quick, because you had asked, you know, how does a script get to me? And I think that's important. So like, not every indie is doing Saw, right? Which is Lionsgate. Lionsgate is an indie, but it's a huge indie, right? So your script right away is probably not going to go to Lionsgate. There are other smaller indies that might be that might be, you know, willing to take that on in some way. Typically, they're going to get projects submitted through an agent, and that project is going to have been packaged in some small way, right? Your agent does not have to be at CAA in order for them to submit it to them, as long as you have or they have a relationship with an executive over there. So it doesn't have to be the biggest and the best, right? But you do almost certainly need representation. What's going to happen is if they like your project, they will probably option it. And they will probably option it for very little money, because that's how the game goes, right? Because this is all super tentative. It's all, yeah, we'll option it for a little bit and we'll see what happens in the market. And if we do big numbers on it, then that's great, because we already say that this person is attached. That doesn't mean they're guaranteed. That just means they're attached. But if then everything comes together and your movie gets made, then great. We'll pull the trigger and you will actually make money. Kind of how it goes. It's why the indie market is the Wild West, because it's crapshoot, right? People playing dice in the alley.
Right. So that's the way it gets you. So do you foresee any big changes in that in 20, like, you know, post strike? There's no change in the pipeline, right? The change is mostly like what people are choosing.
I think that it's actually going to be, it's going to take time for people to restart, right? Because there was a little bit of like residual, like production stuff going on, like in the pipeline stuff that had been previously contracted before the strike started. And so those projects were still able to be completed. But then there was a bit of a lull because the strike went on so long. What is it, like 118 days or something like that? So that there was a bit of a lull. And even though there were quite a few projects that got interim agreements, I think there were also projects that just that weren't able to get it together. And so I think we're kind of seeing things start to rev back up. I've heard several people, I've also seen the trades talk about this, that like they're like, oh, Berlin is going to be, you know, big because there wasn't that much stuff at Cannes. Look, Berlin is almost never big. But if there was going to be like a bigger Berlin where people were bringing like actual interesting projects, maybe this is like the one.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny from the acting point of view, which is something we don't always go into on No Film School, but something that just, you know, recently has come up mostly because of our experience in the strike and conversations. I was talking to a lot of execs who are saying, you know, now's the time to package with A-listers if you have a studio ready script, right? Like you have an action comedy or you have whatever, like people like The Rock, Kevin Hart, Gal Gadot, doesn't matter. You know, like all these A-list actors, Ryan Reynolds, Scarlett Johansson, Florence Pugh, all the people. Anyway, like this is their window, right? Everyone's looking at, I was on strike. A lot of the projects I was attached to before the strike maybe moved or fell apart or aren't being pursued by the studios anymore. Like, is there a first quarter next year, a second quarter next year where I'm definitely available, where I can line up my studio movies so that my star meter on IMDb or whatever you want to call it, really my bank account doesn't go dry and I can do whatever I want. It does feel like I don't want to call it a mad dash for finished specs right now, but it does feel like if you had a spec that was kind of hot that people were putting together, even several years ago, if it's stuck in their crawl or stuck in their mind, people are coming back and knocking on doors now because they need things to go early because of features that are moving, right? You look at like Deadpool 3 was supposed to come out in the summer. Now it's going to be pushed to the fall. Mission Impossible sequel, Dead Reckoning 2, which will get a new title and move to the following year. You know, like there are people with windows who are trying to shoot and get things done. And studios who have not only just like money that they saved during the strike, but have just giant openings next year where they're like, what can we open in May? And looking for, you know, what are those movies and how do they put them together?
Yeah, I think that's 100% accurate. And I think that like, it's so funny because a lot of people, a lot of writers that I know were like, oh yeah, you know, the strike, this is going to be my opportunity. Like it sucks, but like, this is my chance to like, I can just work on my own stuff at home and then I'll be ready when it's over. And then, yeah, I don't actually know that many people who like did that, but they all said they were going to do it. But I think that's an amazing idea. And now is the time where it's like, oh my God, the writer strike was done and they've had like, you know, a few weeks to work on some of their stuff. The actor strike is done. Like, let's rock and roll. Who has something for me and who has something awesome for me? And so it is a little bit of a seller's market. If you're a writer and you have a script or even two scripts and they're like bangers, like it's probably going to be in demand, at least for reads, if not like someone wanting to pick it up. Like, but it has to be ready. It has to be ready to go. Like if you're just starting writing it now, then like, I don't know, that wave may pass you by.
Right. Yeah. You're not seeing like packaged treatments. You're mostly seeing full finished scripts.
Yeah, I it's rare that I get a treatment and someone like views it as like, yeah, this is like a selling document, right? Because that's what a script is, right? A lot of time it's just a selling document. It's happened. I cannot recommend a movie based on that unless like Steven Spielberg wrote it himself.
The package would have to be humongous. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's Spielberg and DiCaprio and, you know, yeah, whatever, you know, Hoyt's going to DP it. And you're just like, well, these people usually make good stuff that sells. So, yeah.
Right.
So yeah, right. Listen.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Finish your script. No treatments are selling. This is the time to do it. One of the other sides of your business, which I touched on briefly, we have a whole article about it. I think actually several articles on No Film School about it. It's your Get Make Consulting, where people pay you money and you get on a Zoom with them and you talk about their scripts, right? So like, I'd love to finish our conversation today just with maybe some advice you have for people who are putting together their scripts now. You know, like what are the, you know, let's say like three factors when you're reading something that says like, oh, like this is a studio movie, you know, or like what are three factors that you're like, this is definitely good. Maybe start with like, this is a studio movie. This is like, you know, a bigger event thing. What do you have like three things that stand out that you're like, when you read something, you're like, oh, this is, you know, how I see it.
Yeah. Let me preface this by saying that like, I work with like with writers, directors, and sometimes actors and producers. And a lot of them are working on getting a script or a package ready to go to the indie market, or they're in the indie market. Maybe they're getting offers. They like don't know. Or some of them are like, oh, how do I get this out there? Can I like creatively improve this? And so I work with them, but I also just want to say that like nobody needs that service. Cause I know there's definitely some like sketchy people out there who are offering similar services for like, I don't know, like $1,000, something obscene that you don't need. So as far as like things that I see that say like studio, like the first thing
studio versus indie. Yeah. How do you pick or you know, where do you recommend it?
I mean, the number one thing that I see is budget, right? Because I'm always thinking to myself, how much is this going to cost? And the reason I think that is because how much is it going to cost to make almost directly translates into how much is this going to cost my clients to buy, right? And so, and the higher something cost, the higher something is budgeted and the higher it costs to buy, the more money it has to make in theatrical. And that means that my clients are taking on a lot more risk in one package, right? Because it's just one movie. So like, if you're like, for example, there have been, you know, countless Liam Neeson Breaks Bad Guy Faces movies that come out over the past, like, let's say 20 years and like, and they're not all taken, right? But they're all priced like they might be the next taken. Thing is, if it's next taken, that's great, but that performs at like baseline expectations. If it's not, then everybody loses money and is sad, including me. So that's the number one thing that I look for is like, is budget. And so then writers might be like, well, I'm not a UPM. How do I know budget? I mean, just some basic understanding of how like physical production works helps everybody, including you, right? There's some, I'm sure like tons of books and materials out there. You probably can think of some. I can look at my bookshelf after this and send you a text or something. But basically, I think that's probably the first thing that I would say is like, know how much your movie costs.
Yeah. Yeah. And accurately, I will say like the conversations I have with people all the time, it's like, don't say, oh, we could do it for 3.5. And then they read it and they're like, this is Titanic. Like, what are we doing here? You know, like know it and know it accurately. Cause honestly, that'll affect who you should be sending it to. You know, like I love A24 as much as everyone else does. It feels like it's like the popular place to say is cool, but I don't think they're making Avatar, you know, like they're not risking the $500 billion budget on it. You know, maybe they'd co-pro with the studio, whatever. It doesn't matter. Like, there's lots of intricacies to that conversation, but you know, if you wrote Avatar, you would be sending it to Fox or Disney or, you know, which are the same place now, or, you know, or Paramount or any of these large spots at, you know, Apple, Amazon, whatever. Like I think A24 would be fun to send it to, but also like, you know, you're taking your shots, same thing with your spec, take your shot somewhere that makes the kind of movies that you've written at that budget level.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like there's enough of a consideration of that. And I should say that I include screenwriters, obviously, sometimes don't take that into consideration. But it feels like sometimes when I like read scripts that are on the blacklist that people are like, oh, man, this is amazing. Like, I can't believe this hasn't been made yet. I'm always like, I know why it hasn't been made yet. It is a like $500 million movie that reads awesome, but is unmakeable.
Right. Yeah.
So not that I'm some genius, by the way, like, I'm just
sure,
some guy,
but totally.
That seems like a pretty... standard thing. So I'm like, well, people are recommending these obviously as like phenomenal pieces of writing, but also, you know, if it's a script, we want it to get turned into a movie, hopefully a great
movie. Yeah. Aside from budget, you know, what are maybe two other things you're like, oh, this is what stands out when I'm reading this, or like things you flag, maybe, you know, for your clients. And then we'll get into like just some generic script advice, I think.
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. So I would say that this is, I think that's pretty common among people who have like read like, you know, thousands of scripts. Like we know by like page three, like if you can write,
right.
But that doesn't, but especially if we are like paid to finish reading the script, that does not mean that your fate has been foreclosed, right? So like there are different aspects of screenwriting that can elevate a script. And so, for example, when I read a script and I'm like, man, somebody like this person is not as strong at writing dialogue. If the rest of the script is really strong, you know, plot-wise, theme-wise, character-wise, but there's a lot less dialogue, I'm like, oh, this person like played to their strengths. And I think that this script is like actually pretty good. And so I would say that a lot of screenwriters don't necessarily play to their strengths. Like you got to know what you're good at. Not everybody's good at everything. There are some people who are not so good at writing dialogue and they're still like relying on characters to just like, you know, expo dump, just like give me all the exposition right here. And I'm like, yo, this is like boring, man. Like please don't bore me with something that you're not good at. And then I'll read like their action set pieces. And I'm like, where was this? This should have been everywhere. You know?
Yeah. Lean into your strengths. Yeah.
Lean into your strengths. I don't see enough of that. And, you know, it's tough because you're you, you read your script, you wrote your script. So you're like, how do I know, you know, have someone you trust, give you feedback, or like, just be ruthless with yourself. It's hard. I mean, screenwriting is hard. So I think that's another thing. What was the last one that you were asking about?
Just, you know, and you've touched on it, maybe danced around a couple of times, just like, you're reading something. What's the moment? Is there a unifying moment where you're like, this is good? This is a recommend. This is, you know, I'm happy that I get to finish this. Is that, you know, I'm sure it's different, you know, nuance with every script, but is, you know, do you have a general feeling of when you get it, when you know?
Yeah, I think there is not enough time spent on coming up with a good idea. And when I say, and to be clear, execution matters with good ideas, because you know there's a lot of people in Hollywood who are like, I'm an idea guy. I'm like, that means you don't do anything, right?
Yeah.
But like, there's not enough time spent on coming up with a good idea, because for me, if I get a script that's submitted by like a client or a professional, you know, and it that means it's going to come with a log line. And if that log line is good, I am excited to read it, right? And sometimes the log line might be like subordinated to the elements involved, right? So for example, like, the logline for John Wick is like not the most original thing ever, right? It's just like, you know, retired hitman, like kills people, like gets his boss. Read that a million times. But if you're like, yo, Keanu Reeves is like avenging his dog.
Right. Yeah.
and it's directed by like former stunt guy and it's awesome. And you're like, okay, I'm way more interested in reading this. Right. So like I think that like when I get a script that I don't know what the log line is for whatever reason. Maybe like a friend is like, hey, I need your take on this. You know, it's my new spec. It's vaguely in this genre or whatever. And I read it when the concept reveals itself to me, which should hopefully happen within like, let's say the first 30 pages, although that's not a hard and fast rule. If I like get the concept and I'm like, oh, this is baller. That's when I'm like excited to read the rest of the script. Right.
Yeah.
And so I feel like there's not enough time spent on that. And I wonder if, especially for writers who are even pre-WGA or maybe just like, they're kind of just like doing it for fun at home or something. I feel like there's a lot of books that kind of like give like formulaic log line recipes.
Absolutely.
And I'm like, I don't know where this like, you know, main character X must do thing Q in order to succeed with Y because of his emotional journey. I'm like, yo, what? Yeah. Why?
Look, as a guy who wrote the logline article with a formula on No Film School, I agree with you. I do think, you know, the one thing we'll always say is like, what's a noisy logline? And the idea is, yeah, like it's, you know, X plus Y equals Z, but there should be a left turn in there, you know? So it's like, like you said, like the generic movie is like a hitman mourning the loss of his wife, you know, decides to get out of the business. But like the left turn is, but after Russian thugs who don't know who he is kill his dog, he's forced back into a life of crime to get the ultimate vengeance. Like, you mean like that left turn of the dog pulls it in? I was talking to a mutual friend that you and I know who will remain nameless, about what's the difference between a good script and like a script that you're like, oh, this is a movie, you know, like this is a movie. And I use Double Indemnity as the example, right? Double Indemnity, if you guys haven't seen it, is about an insurance salesman, and he meets a woman and she's like, let's take out a huge policy on my husband and kill him and we can get the money. And the insurance salesman's like, yes, let's put him on a train, because if he dies on a, you know, in a train accident, it pays out under the Double Indemnity clause. It's great. It's a great movie. One of the greatest, if not the greatest film noir of all time. Certainly one of the greatest movies of all time. Anyway, what makes, you know, what I just told you is that's a great idea for a good script, right? But what makes Double Indemnity one of the greatest screenplays of all time is that when you have one twist, right? It's like, hey, I'm trying to sell you insurance. Let's murder your husband. That's not the end. You know, that could be, that's someone's spec. You know, I think I've written plenty of specs like that, where it's just one thing's happening the whole time. And if you can do one thing well, great. You know, like, congratulations. But what makes that one of the greatest scripts of all time is that the twists keep turning. You know, the cogs continue to spin. It's not just that we're going to kill the husband. It's that the wife might have actually killed the wife previously. You know, it's like the murder is in her vein, that she's tricked maybe other people into murder, that she's now planning to murder you later. Like, it doesn't stop until the end, the final scene. You know, you're constantly guessing, things are constantly twisting around and turning. You know, you think that movie's starting one way, it's ending a different way. And that to me is like what sets it apart, is that, you know, it keeps its foot on the pedal the whole time. It's not just delivering one concept that's good. It's delivering, you know, a great living and breathing document that continues to change as you read it, not that delivers on page 30 and ends on page 90. You're like, oh, great, this gave me exactly what I wanted on page 30. It should give you something you had no idea was coming, you know. And I think like the most effective movies, whether it's Saving Private Ryan or Moonlight or, you know, La La Land, you know, or, you know, any of these, to all the way to Casablanca, Citizen Kane, are delivering you a movie that you had no idea you thought was coming. You know, Citizen Kane, very easy to do, the portrait of a rich guy who dies and nobody knows about him. But, you know, to have the big reveal at the end, sorry, people, spoiler alert for Citizen Kane, is that it, no matter how much money and power he had, he always yearned for his childhood. It's a movie that you didn't know you needed, but it's what delivers, just like Fight Club, you know, winds up being a movie about toxic masculinity and literally fighting with yourself to get through it. You know, and I do think, you know, for those of you listening who have listened to this and they're like, I still don't know how to break in or what to do, 99% of it is writing a great script. And I think we are often looking for that formula or that way in, or, like, you know, as Evan touched on, like getting the right feedback, or, you know, that obsessive click of the button, whether it's The Blacklist or Stage 32 or any of these sites that, you know, where you get a high rating. It's not just that. It is having something great on the page that continues to live and breathe. And as Hollywood changes post-strike, the only surefire way in the door is to have something great people are excited to make. And I don't think that'll ever change.
Yeah, 100%, man. I am constantly looking for something great. I think there's a lot of cynicism out there about, man, Hollywood doesn't make good movies anymore. They just want crap. So what's the point of me and my, you know, brilliant screenplay trying to break in? I'm like, yo, if your screenplay really is brilliant, everybody will want to read it, because most screenplays are not brilliant. Yeah. So if it is really brilliant, like, dude, people are going to be clamoring for it.
I remember this old Hollywood manager. I was talking to her at a party once, a Christmas party at this point a decade ago. And she told me, she's like, there's this great myth in Hollywood that there's 1,000 great screenplays that are just buried somewhere that, like, the town didn't make. She's like, that's fucking bullshit. She's like, there's not, like, we absolutely, sometimes it takes a while, but we make the great ones. There's just a lot of people who think what they've done is great and they're wrong about it. And I just remember, like, it's a tad cynical, but I also think it does feed into, like, if you do have something great and you can push it, you know, take it to the limit, this is the place to get it done. And, you know, the best ideas, hopefully, in some instances, the cream does rise to the top, especially if it's on the page and it's available for huge people to make.
Yeah, I think it generally does rise to the top, which is not to say that Hollywood is entirely a meritocracy, right? Let's not.
Correct.
Let's not
go crazy. Yeah, right? That podcast will never come. Yeah, the meritocracy. Yeah.
Let's not.
It's definitely not.
Yeah, but there is, you know, I remember when the script is really, really good and it's like going around, you know, people will be text each other, hey, did you read that? No, wait. Yeah. Oh, dude, I heard about it. I haven't got it yet. It's on my weekend read list, whatever. Yeah, you got to read it. Here you go. I'll text you. I'll email it to you, whatever.
Yeah.
Like that because people want to read stuff that is good. Because when you read stuff that is good, you're like, oh, this isn't as much of a job anymore, right?
No, it's infectious. Yeah.
And when you read stuff that is bad, which is always, you're like, oh, I'm watching the clock, right?
Yeah. When I was an assistant, I just, your weekend read, you know, on Sunday afternoon after you've watched football, you have like 7 scripts you have to get through. And if even one of them was good, if it was great, you know, maybe take a walk and you're just like, I'm not doing the rest of this reading. This is amazing. I found a great one. But just like the amount of bad stuff you get, the one that was good, I would be like, you got to have a general with this person. It's so good. We have to meet them just because they saved my weekend. You know, and I do think people are so excited to read something good and to, you know, have their socks blown off by great writing. So, you know, as we wrap up here, Evan, is there any kind of other point you wanted to, you know, make or anything you think the listeners should know just about Hollywood's changing landscape and, you know, where we're headed?
Do we have another 3 hours to talk about AI?
Yeah, exactly. We'll definitely have you back for that discussion. We have some fun AI stuff coming up.
Yeah, I think that the number one thing is that, you know, there was I forget when this like speech or whatever happened, but Mark Duplass kind of like gave a speech or something where he kept saying like the cavalry is not coming. But the point is that like, do not wait for everyone else to like tell you yes. Right. You are the one that you can and need to rely on, and like building your own community of people that you want to work with that are talented, that are hardworking, that share your aesthetic sensibilities. That's what's important. That's what the business is, you know, instead of being like, when am I going to get that call from Disney? Like you can, I'm not going to say that you can build your own Disney, but like you can build your own group of people that you want to work with, and it is just as valid and just as enjoyable, and you know, that's also Hollywood. That's how you carve out your own little corner of it. You don't need to rely on everybody else or anybody else. It's hard, but everything about Hollywood is hard.
Yeah, if it was easy, this is the job everyone would do. It's got to be so brutally hard that you know, only the strong survive, or just the, you know, but yeah, find your tribe and it'll be much easier. I do think the older I get, the more thankful I am to have friends I can rely on and people I can work with, especially, you know, the more and more you need reading. Before we go, Evan, you know, go ahead and plug Get Made if you'd like. Tell people where they can find you.
Oh, sure. Yeah, you can go to getmadeconsulting.com, and there's, I believe I have an Instagram and a Twitter, but like I don't really post on them anymore. So
yeah, totally fair. Getmadeconsulting.com. We'll include the link to some of Evan's other articles for No Film School in the podcast thing. As always, I am at Jason Hellerman on Twitter. I'm on the old Blue Sky now, at Jason Hellerman there. I'm at Jason Hellerman on Instagram. And if you want to email me, like the many people I mentioned who inspired this, you know, very special podcast, hashtag, you know, Jason@nofilmschool.com. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks for being with us today, Evan.
Of course. Thanks so much for having me, man.
All right. We'll talk to you, you know, happy listening, and we'll talk to you all next week.